fiddle on the roof. In Fiddler on the Roof, if we talk about choosing a bride or finding a wife, we would probably say that Tevye's daughters did something different from all the generations before them. They refused to honor their father's choices, and they were going to choose who they would marry. This has really been the assumption in historiography throughout the past decades, and I brought here a quotation from Jacob Katz, who was one of the pioneers in saying, let's look at the family. So by quoting Jacob Katz, I don't only want to say that I'm slightly revising what Jacob Katz said, but I also want to point to Jacob Katz as the person who said, stop looking only at what elite, at what the rabbis were doing. If you look at families, if you look at what ordinary people were doing, you can find the signs of change. What he's talking about is the same change that Fiddler on the Roof is talking about. Children no longer agreeing to abide by their parents' decision. So he's talking about a few hundred years later than I talk about. If I'm talking tonight about the 12th and 13th century, he's talking about the 17th and 18th century, and he's saying what changed during that period in comparison to the time we're dwelling in together. And what does he say? And I'll just read these words that I bolded over here. As a rule, the couple themselves had no voice whatsoever in formulating the terms of the agreement. Each party undertook to pay a heavy forfeit for violating the agreement. The parents were given the power to make the match because the parties themselves were young, inexperienced in life, and did not know their own minds. Indeed, the tendency to arrange a marriage as early as possible was typical of the period. This tendency sprung first from the parents' desire to settle their children's future while they were still alive. So Jacob Katz talks about setting up arranging matches as the parents' prerogative. This has been translated fairly simply in work that's followed him into the father's decision. The patriarchal authority was the one who determined who would marry whom, which girls would marry which boys, and certainly which girls would marry. And I think that's where I'll start and finish tonight. The evidence we have of young men shows a lot more agency for young men, and we have many more stories about young men who contract their own marriages, and many scholars have noted that. But as far as girls are concerned, the consensus has been that at least for first marriage, I'm not talking about second marriages, I'm not talking about after divorce, these women were told, or I should say, these girls were told who to marry. Professor Avraham Grossman, one of my teachers, continued this line of thought in his book that some of you may know in Hebrew, others of you may know in English, Chassidot Umoldot, Pious and Rebellious, and he discussed this as well. And I'll get to what he said in just one moment, but the main point he stresses in his writings is how many girls were married under age. When I say as minors, of course I mean in halakhic terms, so under the age of 12. So reading Professor Grossman's work, one gets the impression that increasingly in medieval Europe, Jewish girls are getting married at a very young age, even younger than the age of 12. And he tries to envelope this idea of young Jewish girls getting married according to their father's choices within the context of medieval Europe. And he points to what's going on in medieval Europe at that period, during that period, which is actually a huge change. During the 12th and 13th century, there was a huge change in the medieval church. Marriage became a sacrament. Before that, marriage was not a sacrament. A lot of scholars have written with many different theories about why and how this happened, one of them being that this was the church against the royalty, where girls were married very young and often against the church laws. But the church won the day here. And marriage became a sacrament. Priests oversaw marriage, not quite in the church, often at the doors of the church. And one of the main things that Christian theologians emphasized was that women had to consent to marriage. And I hope some of you see how I'm edging towards Rebecca very, very slowly. I'll get to her in just a moment. I just wanted to give this medieval background. And what does Professor Grossman have to say about that? During the 12th century and thereafter in Christian Europe, there was a firm, widespread opinion in support of marriage, requiring the full agreement of both parties. But this, in fact, did not leave much of a mark on Jewish society. Only a small number of Jewish sages recognized the right of young sons and daughters to choose partners as they will. The accepted norm in Jewish society, in both Muslim countries and in Christian Europe, was for the parents to choose a partner for their children. So once again, we have a reinforcement of this opinion that I just put forward a moment ago concerning parental decision, I would say patriarchal decision, and the very young age of these girls. So what is my quest with you tonight, using Rivka at least as a beginning? My quest with you tonight is to check or to test this assumption and to see if when we examine the medieval literature, this actually holds true. I'm going to use Rivka as the beginning and as the end for this voyage we'll go on tonight, and we'll see where this leads us. So if we have a look at the handout that I gave you, we are returned to Breshit Kafhe, where the text tells us that before Rivka, who agreed to go with Abraham back to her parents' house, and then presents him to her father and then to her mother, is asked, v'nishala lefia, whether or not she would like to return with him to Canaan, to this country that he comes from. And Rashi explains, v'nishala lefia, mikan she'en nesi'in et ha'isha, ela ledata. From this we learn that a woman should not be married without her consent. This already brings some question to what we see here in this general statement, but we can continue. Then in source number two, we see a midrash that probably many of you are familiar with. I have to say that I think this is a midrash that has troubled me since I was a child in kindergarten. So this midrash that we see over here is one that claims that Rivka was so young when she married Yitzchak, or when she was taken to Yitzchak, that she was 3 years old. And we can see that the medieval sages are arguing between themselves, how old was Rivka? So one says she was 3 years old. And the other explains, and whether this is Rabbi Yudav Speyer or Rabbi Shmuel Speyer, it doesn't really make a difference to us right now, that she was 14 when she was betrothed to Isaac. There's a big difference between 3 and 14. And it would seem to me that both Rashi in his statement and these gentlemen from Speyer, who are Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yudah Hasid, the authors of Sefer Hasidim, were probably having a lot of trouble making their peace with this 3-year-old getting married, especially if we think of the Perek in the Tanakh, and we think of all the different things that we've counted there for Eved Avraham and his camels. How exactly could she be 3 years old? Now, if these first two Mefarshim that I brought had some trouble with the idea that she was so young, and talked about the fact that she had to be asked, and I just want to make one more point, that the difference between 3 and 14 is huge, not because we have 11 years that separate between 3 and 14, but also for legal reasons. 14 is over the age of 12, which is the age in which a girl turns from a minor to a major, to someone who's in her own right, whereas 3 is, of course, very, very far away from there. And then we have, I would say, a minority opinion, which I'll get back to a few times later tonight, in which Rabbi Avigdor HaTzarfati says, despite the fact that she was still a minor. And he says, Rabbi Avigdor HaTzarfati, although he's called the Tzarfati, spent most of his life in what we would call Austria today. And he says, Mikan nehagu b'Tzarfat, so he's talking about the custom there or someplace else, la'asiv notehen she'en k'tanot u'lekadsham mishum tzni'ut. And this is why they are accustomed to engage their daughters when they were still minors in France, for reasons of modesty. So we can see that maybe there are some places where girls are married at a very young age, but I would say that it's pretty obvious from what Rabbi Avigdor himself is saying that that is not the custom surrounding him. So even by just reading the Mefarshim on Rivka, we can see a certain unease with the idea of women being asked to marry without consent. And if we compare these Jewish Mefarshim to just a moment, to three and almost random choices that I made today of Christian commentators on this matter, we can see the same idea coming across from them. Augustine of Hippo, of course, is from late antiquity, so he's much further back. But what he says is that without the agreement of Rebecca, without her saying, Vadam, I will go, we wouldn't have here, Eleazar would not be able to bring her, or the slave of Abraham would not be able to bring her to Isaac. And the same way, without belief in the church, and without believers being willing to say, I believe, the church would not have its believers. So that's one example, which is much more antique. Hugo of Saint-Cher, who is a 13th century Frenchman himself, says that when someone gets married, you have to have the consensus of the wife. You have to have her agreement to marry in order to have the marriage made. And Nicholas of Lyra, who often follows Rashi in his commentary, says that matrimony requires express consent. So we have Christian commentators making very similar comments to the one that we at least saw Rashi making. And what I would argue here is that perhaps medieval Jews are very much aware of the debate that's going on around them concerning marriage, and they're thinking about this matter very seriously as well. So if we continue from just this peek at the Christian consensus, we can turn to the Sugya and the Bavli, which really is the basis of everything we're talking about. And that's what you have in source number 4. And after that, I'll try to present to you how I'd like us to work tonight and try to test these different assumptions. So source number 4 tells us that a man may give his daughter in betrothal when she is a na'ara. She's not a minor anymore. She's not a major anymore between age 12 and 12 and a half, but not when a minor. And this supports Rav. For Rav Yudah said in Rav's name, one may not give his daughter in betrothal when a minor, but must wait until she grows up and says, I want so and so. So already in the Talmud, we have an argument about whether or not it's okay for a man to decide for his daughter who she will marry without her consent. And at least one of the opinions in the Talmud is that a man may not marry his daughter until she's old enough to say, I want so and so, or until she's old enough to refuse the marriage that her father wanted to make for her. So this seems to be the general opinion. So if so, where does this idea that Rivka was 3 years old come from? Where does this idea that some people marry their daughters off when they're still minors? I would say this is what was accepted in many parts of the Muslim world, where the general custom was to marry girls off at a very young age. When we move into medieval Ashkenaz, and Rashi is really one of the earliest commentators we have, we find Jewish commentators making remarks that really resemble the practice around them, which is that you don't marry girls off before they are the age of majority and can say, this is who I want so and so. Now, all this sounds very straightforward, and you're all shaking your heads and saying yes, but where did Yaakov Katz and Abraham Grossman, with who I began with, get this idea that the girls were minors and that no one was asking them for their opinion? If I were to say they saw Fiddler on the Roof, that would, of course, be just saying that they were to be blamed for anachronism, which isn't a terrible thing because we all sin with some kind of anachronism once in a while. But, of course, that's not the right answer. Where do they get this idea from? So what I want to argue before you tonight is that historians who have been studying medieval Jewish life have looked mainly at one kind of literature. And you'll see I put up a little picture here to symbolize that kind of literature, and that's halakhic literature. Why did I choose this picture here? Because in this picture, which is from a 13th century machzor, you can see the chatan, the kala, who's completely covered. You can't see her at all. You can just see her underneath that veil. And next to them, you can see the rabbi. So that was my halakhic symbol. The second kind of literature we'll look at is moral exempla. And moral exempla, as you will see, includes the entire family in the discussion. And that's why we have the chatan and kala. But next to them, and maybe you'll see it a little bit better later on, you have the very worried mother looking on at the chuppah. So she was my way of trying to say we have a much wider circle here. And the final source I want us to look at, which isn't on your handout because it's still in manuscript, so I'll be reading it to you and showing it to you, is a source that does not reflect reality in any way, but might reflect the way people like to think about matters such as marriage. And what do I mean? I mean stories. Stories Jews told during the medieval period. These stories exist in Hebrew in a number of select manuscripts, and I'll just be bringing one of them towards the end of my talk tonight to give you some idea of how marriage and making a marriage is discussed. So the two questions I want to put before us in order to reassess these questions using Rivka as my symbol of this tension in society, and the Pirushim about her as a comment on this tension, is what age were most girls when they got married, and did they have to agree to this marriage in medieval times? So first, let's have a look at the halachic literature. The first halachic source, you can see in front of you on the source sheet, and I put the number on my slide, so you can always look along with me as you're looking at the sheet in front of you, is source number 5. That same passage in Masechet Kiddushin that we just read now, we have a Tosfot about that passage. Now, what is the argument in that sugya in the Gemara? One of the things they're arguing about is whether a woman would rather be married and unhappy or not married at all. And that is what they're discussing, and that is a principle that still to this day is very central in rabbinic rulings on divorce. So it's not a principle that we can only smile about, it's one that has many consequences even today. In any case, what do the Tosfot say about this principle? This pertains to a woman who is married by herself, and if she agrees to the marriage, we don't have to fear that she will regret it. But a minor who was married by her father, one has to fear that if she was of age, she wouldn't agree. So what are the Tosfot telling us now? They're saying a father has the right to marry off his minor daughter, but it's not something that's such a good idea. And that's what the Talmud is trying to tell us. That's why Rav Yehuda, saying in Rav's name, is trying to tell us that one shouldn't marry off their minor daughter, because who knows what will happen when she gets older, and perhaps she's unhappy with the choice that was made. But now comes the important part, and I hope it starts to ring a bell to something we already read. And now, we are accustomed to betrothing our daughters even when they are minors, because each day the galut is overcoming us. And if one has the ability to give his daughter a dowry now, perhaps he will not be able to in time, and his daughter will remain an aguna forever. A few remarks about this source. First of all, I want you to note that they're not necessarily using halachic terminology. A woman who doesn't get married is not an aguna. So we can already see that there's some kind of exaggeration here in this source just by looking at the words they're using. Because a woman will not be an aguna if she's never married. The second thing that comes across here is that each day the galut is overcoming us. We live in a time of hardship. So the historical question we have to ask is, when was this written? Now, it's very easy to say the Tosafist comments on the commentaries on the Talmud were written during the 12th and 13th, maybe also 14th century, and we can give a kind of a broad landscape of that sort. But of course, those of us who study these texts know that you can actually identify the author of the different Tosafists on the different Masachtot. This one, on Masechet Kiddushin, was written in northern France in the late 13th century. Even more specifically, it was written in the town of Evreux, where there was a very certain yeshiva that in which the rabbis expressed opinions that not everyone always agreed with. They're known for their very extreme opinions. So here we have one source. Now, if you look at Professor Katz and Professor Grossman's footnotes, they quote this source. This is one of the main sources they base their generalization on, that girls are married under the age of 12 and the matches are determined by their father. Second comment that appears in all the footnotes is source number 6 that you see before you. They talk here about the fact that you have to ask a girl if she wants to marry someone or not, and they say, V'hanilile, and these words are said, in the days when Yisrael were rabim b'makom echad, there were many Jews in one place. But now, when we are few, we are used to betrothing, even a minor, lest someone else take him. Here we have proof number 2. Now, I'm a medievalist, which means I like to have as much proof as possible for the statements I make, but sometimes I only have 4 or 5 sources. Those of you who deal with late antiquity or with antiquity know that sometimes you only have 2 sources, and you can write an article about 2 sources. Us medievalists, we like to have a little bit more, but here we already have 2 sources, right? So the second source that says more or less the same thing, and if we add this to the source we saw before, source number 3, Rabbi Avigdor HaTzarfatit, we're starting to get a picture of France. Why do I say a picture of France? Because Rabbi Peretz Ben Eliyahu of Corbe was a student in that same yeshiva of Evreux that I just talked about a moment ago, where the Tosafot were written. So what I'm saying here is we have 3 statements of girls being married under the age of 12 by their fathers. But these three statements are really one. They're all from late 13th century France, from the same yeshiva, from the same place. Moreover, we can see here that each of the different authors who's speaking is saying what we have here is something that's extraordinary. This isn't the way we usually do it. This is what we're doing now in these very specific circumstances. What's going on in France during these years? The Jews are being expelled and readmitted, hardships against them, new laws against them, their money is being taken away. We're talking about a very specific set of circumstances at this time. So I brought you two of the three sources, or three of the four sources that are usually brought to prove this point. And now to my last halachic source. My last halachic source is actually from the 15th century. It's from Sefer Trumat Hadeshen, and it's quoting a story about Rabbi Meir of Rotenburg. So it's going back to the end of the 13th century. And what we hear in this story is that Rabbi Meir of Rotenburg also married his daughter off when she was a minor. And that's what he says. V'chel aseti v'biti ktana. But he also says, I said to her, my daughter, accept your kiddushin if you wish to accept them. So what we have here is a kind of combination. Yes, she is being married off when she's very young, but she is being asked to consent to this marriage. Now this is a 15th century testimony about something that happened in the late 13th century. I don't want to knock anyone's credibility, but it is a report from many years later back to the past. And I would say that it's also a report from a period in which I can tell you that very young girls were in arranged marriage by their parents. In other words, in the 15th century, this would be true. And that is something that allowed Jacob Katz and others to bring this reality up through the 17th and 18th centuries. But in the 13th century, in the 12th century, it would seem even from the halachic sources that girls are not being married under the age of 12 and that they are being asked to consent to those marriages. So we saw one sort of source. Now let's move on to our second sort of source. And that is the source, and I'm skipping source number 8 for now, I'll go back to it later if we have time. These are the moral exemplars. So the moral example I'm bringing you tonight are all from the same book. They were all written by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Jacob and Samuel the Pious. And he is that same Rabbi Yehuda who is referred to in source number 2. So we might say we have two schools of thought here when we base ourselves on these sources. And he tells lots of stories. I brought 4 or 5 of them tonight. There's an extra one in the PowerPoint that's not in the source sheet. There's an extra one in the source sheet that's not in the PowerPoint. You'll get an extra one in either way. And you'll see that I could just go on forever telling these stories tonight. Many of them are quite amusing, but they really do give us quite a different picture. Now, this is moral advice. Is this what actually he's recommending? Is this what's actually happening? That's a good question. But I think from what he's saying, we can try to be a little bit more exact. So he tells us about someone who takes a ktana, and I'm looking at the Hebrew now for a minute on purpose, when there is a gdola. A man is looking for a wife, and he decides to marry a ktana, although there's a gdola, who's available. What does that mean? So the words ktana and gdola seem to hint to some kind of halakhic terminology, right? A ktana is a minor under the age of 12, and a gdola is someone who's come of age. But you'll see in a minute that just like an aguna wasn't an aguna a moment ago, these ktanot and gdolot are not exactly ktanot and gdolot. So they ask, lama lokeach ktana? Why will he take a younger woman when there's an older woman, when they are both of equally good parentage? So we don't hear anything about attraction or good reasons to marry a woman. We just hear that they come from good families. It seems to fit our matchmaking paradigm that we have. And then they say, in any case, even if she is 13, although most girls don't give birth until they are 16, if there are no older girls, he can take her because she is capable of giving birth. What does this mean? That our ktana is 13. Our gdola is 16. In other words, we have no ktanot to our minors here. We're talking only about girls who are over age already. The only distinction they're making here is between girls who are able to give birth already and girls who are not. And here I can tell you that one of the biggest surprises I had as a graduate student when I was going through medieval medical manuscripts, was a manuscript that comes from southern France, not from northern France, in which there were instructions on contraception. So the doctor was giving instructions on contraception, and he was talking about how one should instruct 13 and 14-year-old girls to prevent getting pregnant. And he writes, V'chol ish hayireh Elohim yesh lo lahadrich banot b'derech zo. So he says, any man who fears God should instruct girls not to get pregnant when they're 13 or 14. And he continues and explains, kishvidehem tzarot, because their paths, their bodies are so narrow, and they will die in birth. Now, I've asked a few of my friends who are OBGYNs, and they all confirm that 16-year-olds can have babies, whereas 13 or 14-year-olds, that's a very, very dangerous thing for them to do, although in our world today, we hear about girls that age who have babies. But in any case, getting back to my point, these girls are not under 12. In other words, we're not marrying off minors in any way, according to this source.
Excuse me.
Sure.
Why does it say in the beginning, "Shiyesh gdola az chote"?
Okay, because they're talking about the fact that in the Talmud it says that anyone who marries a ktana, any zaken who marries a ktana, ma'akevet ha-mashiach. That's what it says in the Talmud. So he's commenting on that phrase in the Talmud. And that's the chet he's doing. And this is also a social way of saying, don't marry a young girl because you are performing some kind of sin.
So why did they even marry off such young girls if the Jewish mantra is proved rude?
Okay, well, I think here we have a very interesting medieval development also. I already told you last time everything, I think, starts in the medieval period. But we have a very interesting medieval development, which is a question of what you do about contraception. According to the Mishnah in Masechet Nidah, there are three kinds of women who are allowed to use contraception. A pregnant woman, because they believe that you can get pregnant again, and a nursing woman, a woman who's nursing her baby and doesn't want to conceive, so she will use some form of contraception to prevent conception, and a ktana, a minor, or a young girl, who we don't want her to get pregnant. According to Jewish law, those are the three kinds of women who are allowed to use contraception. Rabbeinu Tam, who's a medieval Tosafist from more or less our time, says even more than that. He says not that they can use contraception, they must use contraception. In other words, it's very dangerous not to allow them to prevent conceiving. During the same period in the 13th century, there are some people who start arguing about that. And they say, Min Hashamayim Yirachemu, let Hashem take care of it. Whatever happens, happens. They shouldn't use any form of contraception. So actually, Jewish attitudes towards contraception changed, I would say, very radically in the 13th century. And that's another topic, not for this talk. I don't have a biblical figure to connect that to, so I can't talk about it in this series. But that is another topic for a different talk. So let's go have a look at the other source in Sefer Chassidim. Okay. So, source number 10 on your source sheet. And it happened that they wanted to give a young woman to an older man. Now, I want you to look at the phrases here. They don't say ktana, right? They just say they want to give a betula. So she's a young girl, lizaken, to an older man. And if you want to know how old he is, this source will tell us. And the old man did not want the match, lest he cause her to sin. They said to him, after all, she desires you. The old man went and removed his hat. I'm sorry? They said to him, after all, she desires you. She would like to marry you. Oh, did I have a type here? I'm sorry. This is correct. So after all, yes, v'halo, he's v'chitzavacha. After all, she desires you. The old man went and removed his hat and said to her, see that I am old and my hair is full of gray and other things that are the result of old age. So you won't say, I didn't know. And she said, even if I could only wash the feet of my master, we'll get back to that verse in my last talk when I talk about Abigail, right? Only let me bear your name. And they had children who were great scholars. So what do we learn from this story? First of all, we have no idea how old she is, but she's old enough to have an opinion. And now I'm coming to the matter of consent. Nobody's talking to her father. This woman is a bit too loud. Nobody's talking to her brother. Nobody's talking to her mother, her uncle, some other man in her family who's making the decisions for her. She's the person being asked. I would say she's surely over the age of 12, but even more than that, her consent is being asked for. in this story. And I'll just have to say that if I had to give another talk about dyeing your hair in the Middle Ages, Sefer Chasidim is filled with wisdom about dyeing your hair so you look younger. And this is one of the examples you can find in which they talk about the gray in your hair and how you'd like to change it. So that, too, is not a modern phenomenon. Okay, source number 12.
Why does he say, I don't want to marry her because she'll sin? What's she going to sin about?
No, he doesn't say she'll sin. He says, I don't want to marry her because she'll regret it. Because she might later on go look for another young man and maybe, God forbid, have some kind of adulterous relationship with him because she's not happy at home with him. That's what Rabbi the Chassid is worried about here. Okay.
There's a word there for a mechat talut.
Right. So maybe she'll say, I made a mistake, I didn't realize.
I didn't know, you deceived me with that dying in the head.
Right, and that would be...
And therefore, retroactively, you could do your
part. So that would be a ground for annulling the Kiddushin, for saying the Kiddushin weren't valid. So we have here a few different ideas. One is the adultery, one is to say that this was a Kahuda, I hadn't meant to marry you. But in any case, she's definitely overage, and she is definitely asked to consent. Source number 12. one man, and this is a really interesting source, coveted a young woman. Now, I want you to notice the word in Hebrew, chamad, right? Echad haya chomed betula. And he sent to speak with her, and she did not desire him, nor did her relatives. He said to his father and his mother, if you do not toil so that this woman will be my wife, I will convert. This is kind of like the ultimate suicide that teenagers will say to their parents. Mm-hmm. That's what we're hearing here. And there are a few really nice sources in Sefer Chasidim, and we'll... maybe see another example later, in which the young man who doesn't get his way says, I'll convert. That's his best threat against his parents. I'll become a Christian. So what did his parents do? His father and mother said to their relatives, this and that is what my son said. They asked the sage if they could take on two witnesses who would testify that he married her before them so that he would not convert. This is really a very bad thing to do. They want two edim who will lie and say they saw something that actually never occurred. The sage said, let him convert, and let them not testify falsely. Furthermore, it is better that he converts than that a daughter of Israel shall be lost to this wretched man. And since he said this, in the end he will convert or do evil like a convert. So there's a lot of mussar here. I'm going to leave the mussar alone because I want to focus again on the question of marriage. How did this man go about setting up a match he wants? He talks to his parents, but he also... talks to the woman and to her relatives. So we can see a much more complicated way of creating a marriage here than a father coming in and saying, I've decided you are going to marry so-and-so, which is the way that we really imagine it when we read the historical textbooks that talk about medieval marriage. It's even the way we imagine it when we see the first scene of tradition. I showed it to my students a few weeks ago. A Fiddler on the Roof, you know, the song of tradition. I showed it to my students a few weeks ago, and they were completely shocked by the idea that this was the way things really had been, but this was their stereotype as well. So what we have here is, again, some way of arranging a marriage, a man sending messages both to the woman and to her relatives. I want to say even more than that. These young people know each other. How did he send to marry this woman if he didn't know who she was, what she looked like? Where did this idea come from? He didn't just pull her name out of a hat. So we have some kind of acquaintance between them. And this next story, if I haven't convinced you yet, I hope this story will convince you. This next story tells the story somewhat differently. And that is source number 13 here on the source sheet. And you can see the involvement of many different people in making this match. One Jew sought after a woman. You can see that this is a much more positive story. This guy is not someone who will convert or be like a convert, so we don't have all these bad things to say about him. So instead we have, Yudia Chanaya Chafetz B'Ishachat, Shaya Ohev Ota V'Hi Oto. He loved her, and she loved him. Now, in a world in which we imagine young people being married off without anyone asking their opinion, we don't have young men and women who are already in love with each other. What does he do? Shalach, he sent matchmakers to her father and to her mother, and they said, our daughter does not want this match. Now, this is really important to me as part of my talk tonight. I don't want you to walk out of here afterwards and say, oh, the medieval period was just like our day. The young man and woman came home from Bnei Akiva or from wherever it was that they met each other, and they announced to their parents, we're getting married. There is a way to do this in the medieval period. And the way to do this in the medieval period is by talking to the parents, with or without matchmakers. So he sends matchmakers to the parents, but they're not so connected to their teenager. And they say, our daughter doesn't want this match. So she sends him a message secretly and says, I do want you, but my father and mother are engaged in a different match. Just wait, because he will not take me. And afterwards, they will busy themselves with me for you. So she has a strategy all planned out here. This won't work out. You'll be next in line. And of course, I love the next line, which is just busy yourself primarily with how we can support ourselves. So if you want to convince my parents that you're a good match, get to work. Find something to do. This guy has a really long story. I didn't bring you the whole thing. But this match doesn't work out. Then he falls in love with another woman who has the same name. And that doesn't work out. He starts fasting, praying to God, because his luck is always so terrible. And he's really a very, very sad case that Rabbi Yehuda Hasid wants us to learn from. What does he want us to learn? He wants us to learn that you have to do this the right way. And if you do it properly, these matches can work. So that was my second category, the moral literature.
The language of he will not take me goes against your idea that you're talking about, that it's up to her, because otherwise it should say, just wait because I will not take him. It doesn't say that. It says he will not take me.
Okay, but I think in this case you can even say that she's saying that's not going to work. In other words, he's going to say no.
Yeah,
so that match would
just be... she's saying it bothers me.
I mean, you might be right. It's very, very hard to judge this Hebrew. That's why the chamad and ohev is very hard kind of...
okay.
Exactly, you're right. I mean, he says lo yikachani, but the Hebrew phrase we usually word is ki yikach ish isha. So we're really just using the Hebrew that we know from the Bible.
If you're saying this match did not work out, so the strategy didn't happen.
Well, strategy didn't happen because he was impatient. So that's part of what he's trying to... I'm sorry that I'm making noise. That's part of what Rabbi Yehuda Hasid is trying to kind of give moral advice on, that you should be a little bit more patient. Don't run after these matches. Take things as they come in good time. And that's why this match doesn't work out. It's just kind of a funny story how it continues. So we've seen now two genres. One is the halachic genre. My argument about the halachic genre was it was very specific to time and place. We certainly can't say all Jews in medieval Northern Europe are marrying their daughters off as 12-year-olds or under the age of 12 without their consent. The second was the moral exemplar, in which we definitely see a lot of space for the children to negotiate, mothers and fathers, not just fathers, and a lot of other relatives involved, as well as the rabbis. And the third genre is the one that you don't have in front of you, and those are the stories that appear in medieval manuscripts. Okay, I'll skip this now, maybe if we have time later, I'll come back to it. So what is this manuscript I want to talk to you about? This manuscript is a book called Sefer HaMaasim. Why is it called Sefer HaMaasim? Because every story starts with the word Maaseh. And that's why it's called Sefer HaMaasim. These are 66 stories that were written in the early 13th century in northern France. Why am I stressing northern France? Because if we talk about a place where there was difficulty before, and maybe they were marrying off young girls 50 or 60 years later, this manuscript represents a period of about, I'd say, 60 years before those Tosfot that we saw before were written. And Sefer HaMaasim has a lot of really, really wonderful stories. I'm just going to tell you one main story tonight, and the others will have to wait for some other time. And this is a story that is an expansion of a story that already appears in the Talmud. So maybe some of you are familiar with it. In the Talmud, Masechet Ta'anit, they talk about Balei Emunah, who are people of great belief. And they say that these Baalei Emunah are Chulda Vibor. That's what the Talmud says. Chulda Vibor, a rat or a weasel, and a cistern, these are proof of belief. Now, when you read the Talmud, it's not at all clear what the Talmud is talking about. And that's when we need Rashi, of course. So what you have in front of you here is Rashi from Masechet Ta'anit. What does Rashi tell us? How did a rat and a cistern prove their belief, or prove that they were reliable? Shehemitu shnei bnei adam. They killed two people. And he tells us a story. It is found in the Agadah, and I should say that although Rashi says it is found in an Agadah, this Agadah is not well known before Rashi's Pirush. Once there was a boy who gave his pledge to a maiden that he would marry her. She asked, who will be the witness? There was a cistern and a rat there. The man said, the cistern and rat are witnesses to this. After time, he broke his faith, emunato, that's what we're talking about here, and married another, and fathered two sons. One fell into a cistern and died. The other was bitten by a rat and died. His wife asked, "Why are our boys dying such strange deaths?" And he told her, "This is what happened." That is the story that Rashi tells us. This is how he explains it. What happens in Sefer HaMaasim? The author of Sefer HaMaasim takes these five lines in the Hebrew and turns it into a 50-line story. So they tell this story with a lot of extra detail. And that extra detail can tell us something about how they view this event and the meeting between this girl and this man. So I'll read you the story in a short version, and part of what I'll read we'll have up here. So this is the story. If it sounds like Little Red Riding Hood, perhaps it's not a coincidence. Once there was a young maiden who was walking to her mother's house, and she was adorned with silver and gold. She's not wearing a red cape, but she's adorned with silver and gold. Maybe she's out to look for a husband, or I don't know exactly where she's going or why she's going there. And she erred on her way and walked without coming to a place of residence. Since half the day had passed, she became thirsty and did not have any water. She saw a well and a rope for a bucket to hang on it. She held onto the rope and lowered herself in the well and drank. When she wanted to climb out, she couldn't, and she screamed and cried until a person passed by and heard her voice and looked for her but couldn't see her. He starts asking her lots of questions. Are you a ghost? Are you a witch? Are you a devil? He starts asking her all these different questions because he hears this voice coming from inside the well. He doesn't know who she is. And finally he says to her, "I will help you up if you will promise to marry me." She agreed. When he pulled her up, he wished to immediately have sexual relations with her. So what we have here is a rape. This man wants to rape this girl immediately when he pulls her up out of the cistern. And she says to him, "What people are you from?" He replied, "I am Jewish, and I am from such and such a place, and I am a Kohen. I am also from the place where these known people come from," and he named specific people. She said to him, "A holy people such as yours, and God has chosen you from all of Israel and sanctified you, and you wish to behave like an animal without kiddushin and without a ketubah? Follow me to my fathers and mothers, and I will become engaged to you." Now, what's so interesting to me in this story? She doesn't say, well, I guess she made a promise and she wants to keep her word, but she doesn't say, "Oh no, what will my father say? I just promised to marry a man, he hasn't decided for me." She's very confident in the story, and that's what I love about the story, that if he follows her, everything will be okay. In any case, he says to her, "Let's make a covenant with each other." He said to her, "Who will be a witness between us?" And a rat passed by them. He said to her, "The sky and the rat and the cistern will be witnesses." Each of them went on their own way. The girl stood fast to her vow, and anyone who came to claim her hand in marriage, she would refuse. So we have...
She was going to take him to her
Yeah, but
parents.
He didn't want to come back with her. He had places to go, and she had places to go, and they were going to meet up sometime in the future. They promised each other, and each went on their way. She goes back home, he doesn't come, and he doesn't come, and she stays steadfast. And anyone who came to claim her, she would refuse. Because she was being coerced to marry, so it's already become too many refusals. At this point, parental authority kicks in. And her parents say, "You have to get married. We will decide who you're marrying." She tore her clothes. She began to behave as if she were mad. And she had seizures, and she tore her clothes, and the clothes of anyone who tried to touch her, until people avoided her. So this is how the story continues. We hear what happens in this girl's world. And in the meantime, he goes back home. And this is what the story tells us. And he, the man, because he did not see her any longer, his desire left him. And he forgot her, and he went to his city. And he married another woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When he was 3 months old, a rat choked him. And she conceived again and gave birth to a son, and he fell into a cistern. The wife said to the man, "If the children had died the way most people die, I would accept the judgment of God. But now that they have died in such strange ways, it is not for no reason. Tell me, what have you done?" He told her the events, and she divorced him. This is interesting for you, Rina, because in this case, she divorced him, not he divorced her. I don't know if we can read anything into that, but it's still an interesting comment. And she sends him on his way. He went and asked about that young woman. He was told, and that's what she says to him, "Go to your faith that God destined for you." He went and asked about that young woman. He was told, she has seizures, and anyone who seeks to marry her, this is what she does to him. He went to her father and told him the entire account of the rat and the cistern. He said to the father, I accept her with all of her faults. We're going back to what you said before. I accept her with all of her faults. These are her faults, and I know it before I get married to her. He brought witnesses, and she began to act as she always did. And he told her about the rat and the cistern. She said to him, I also kept my promise, and immediately returned to sanity. And they were fruitful and multiplied with children and wealth. So this is just a story. Just a story. I'm not trying to argue that medieval life worked according to this story. But what I am trying to argue, yes, question?
Are these stories told to?
Oh, it's a great question. We have 66 stories of this sort. Many of them are expansions of stories we have from the Midrash, from the Agadah, just like in this case where I wrote you the Rashi version and then this expanded version. If we had another hour, I could probably tell three or four more, in which we have very active young men and young women. We even have another man threatening to commit suicide because they won't let him marry the woman that he loves. We don't know who they were told to, because they're written in Hebrew, and we assume most people didn't understand the Hebrew, but they were probably used for speeches, for drashot. So they probably served people who gave the drashot. This manuscript is a manuscript full of stories. And the person who copied them, you can see he copied them very carefully, so people could use them and read them aloud. And we also find echoes of these stories in a lot of piyutim that were written during the period, in a lot of parshanut, whether on the Bible, on the Talmud, or on the piyutim themselves. So we have a lot of evidence that these stories are very current.
Are they written by one person or by different people?
I don't know. They're written in one hand in the manuscript. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that he didn't collect them from a lot of different sources. Mm-hmm. A lot of them form what later becomes the Maisavot in Yiddish, mm-hmm. Which we're familiar with from later scholars. But I can't say more about this manuscript except that it's from the early 13th century, northern France, and has a lot of traditions that are very similar to neighboring traditions, which is why the picture I brought here is a kind of a very courtly couple, like the courtly literature that we read in Christian society during that period, which, by the way, we know Jews read a lot because the Tosafists scold their students not to read these books in the bathrooms on Shabbat. So we know that Jews are reading these books during the medieval period. So if I come back to the evidence I've been trying to present to you tonight, what I would say is that I can't argue that minor girls never got married in medieval Ashkenaz. Certainly, in 13th century France, it seems that we have a period in which a certain group of people are marrying off their daughters, even when they're minors, because of the very pressing circumstances of the period. But to generalize, like we saw at the beginning, that most marriages were determined only by parents, children had no say, and many of the brides were minors, would seem very incorrect. And let's see if this will work. I tried to open this up before. What you can see here in front of you, and I hope you can see it from where you are, is a page of Machzor Vitri, which is a manuscript written by a book written by Rashi's students, in which they have many, many of the instructions of how to conduct rituals. What's very, very interesting here is that this manuscript is from the early 13th century, from 1204. But what we have besides the manuscript itself is we also have a commentary that explains things. I don't know if you can see that from where you are, but what we have here is Harei at Mekudeshet Mitabad Zo Kedat, let me turn this off so you can see that, Kedat Moshe B'Yisrael. I blew up this page from the manuscript. And over here we have instructions how to actually conduct the ceremony. And they say, etc., etc., and the chatan puts the ring on the tabad's finger, and then it says, "In ktanahi yomar kach la'avia o la'achia." So we do have instructions in this margin of this book from northern France that tells us what to do if there is a ktana. So it's not like it never happened, but these are not the regular instructions. This isn't something that happens every time from looking at this book. This is something that happened once in a while. So what I'm trying to suggest to you tonight is a revision of the way we've seen history. And I started with Rivka because I think her story really represents this tension. And through the parashanut on this story, we can find this tension. And I want to end with something that's really quite special, also from Achzor Vitri, and that's source number 14 on your handout. And I have to apologize, I saw a very bad typo when I printed it out today, and I was going over my notes for the lecture, so I apologize in advance for what my computer did there. What do we have here? What we have here is a very colloquial, very low-level piyut. Most piyutim that were sung at weddings are very complex. Follow the imagery in them. You have to know Shir HaShirim by heart. It wouldn't hurt to know all the other books in the Bible as well. And if you use some midrashim, that would also be very good. What you have here is a simple piyut that was sung by people with responses. And what I like about it so much is that you can really see how people who sung this song could identify with it. And of course, I have Rivka here, which is why I thought it would be really nice to finish with it. So, Yivarech Hashem Chatan Vekala, Kema Deberech Shmaya Ve'ara, like He blessed heaven and earth. Yivarech Hashem Chatan Vekala, Kema Sheberech Shamsha Ve'sahara, the sun and the moon. Yivarechem Ba'ava Ve'achva, Kema Deberech Adam Ve'chava. Yivarechem Hashem Ba'kol Milchasra, Kema Deberech Avraham Ve'sara. Yivarechem Hashem Be'irato Ve'davka, Kema Deberech Yitzchak Ve'rivka. And he goes on and on, and gives this young couple brachot using the different figures in the Bible. So what I'd like to do now in conclusion is just to say that once again, like I opened my lecture last week, I think these biblical models are really models that speak to medieval people, not just to the elite, but also to the people who are getting married, who are making these decisions every day. I think the story of Rivka is a story of tension that exists in medieval society. The tensions are economic, political, social, there are many tensions, and that's the galut shemitgaberet. That's the reason why some of these men see the need to marry their daughters off so young and not to give them any choice. But at the same time, if we read through the medieval literature, we can also see an opinion that says Rivka wasn't 3 years old, she was 14, and she agreed, and she went after that man. And so too, the couples that are being made in medieval Ashkenaz have to agree and have to go together. That's it for tonight. Let me just say a word about next week. As you can see, those of you who were here last week, I'm trying to use the Bible each time in a slightly different way. I would say tonight was my weakest connection to the Bible, in that we've opened and closed our lecture, but most of the lecture had to do with other issues. Next week, I'm going to be sticking very close to the Bible. I want to talk about Bat Yiftach, the daughter of Yiftach, one of the most difficult stories to read in the Bible. And what I want to suggest to you is how medieval women remembered Bat Yiftach, because we know that in that story we hear that every year, 4 days a year, Telachna, right? Livkot Bat Yiftach. We hear that this is the Chok Miyamim Yamima in that chapter of Shoftim. And also, through this remembering Bat Yiftach, we become a little bit more familiar with a medieval custom that actually existed after the Holocaust in many, many communities. So I hope to see you next week, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are any. Thank you very much.
Where does Erusin fit in here? Because I had understood that they would use Erusin when they were married very, very young, and then the final part would be the Kiddushin part.
Okay, so that's a great question. I'm not sure I have an entire answer. I have a partial answer. So we know from the Mishnah and the Talmud that girls would become betrothed, and then they usually had a year to get ready for their wedding, or even longer sometimes. I should just mention that also my colleagues who work on late antique literature don't think that many girls were being married as minors in the period of the Talmud. So that's kind of a conclusion that goes against common myths that we could say across the periods. Professor Adi Schremer, one of my colleagues at Bar-Ilan University, who wrote a book about marriage in antiquity, one of the main points he made in his book is that men were married much later than 18, Ben Shmona Asra L'Chuppah, but he also made the point that girls weren't quite as young as we thought they were. Gniza material shows that girls were usually between age 12 and 12 and a half, and now I'm getting back to your question. So according to the Mishnah and the Talmud, it seems that girls were engaged, and then some time went by, and that allowed them to mature. In medieval Ashkenaz, from what we know from Rashi's period and on, usually, and I say usually because there are some exceptions, usually the Erusin and Kiddushin took place together. Rashi explains it as financial. Financial that you want to have only one party, so you might as well do everything together. That might just be an excuse. The real reason is that having Erusin before the Nisuin and separating them in that way can be very problematic. What do you do if something happened to the man in question, to the woman in question? You have these two people who are really agunot. They're bound to each other forever, and then we can't solve that problem. So that is a problem.
So that's what I wondered in that source about that. Was that not that kind of... Maybe that is what they were talking about. And that she was an aguna because of that.
So it could be that we can interpret that source, that if you've already made the match and you have to wait till they get married, you may as well do it right away when you have the money.
Right.
So that could be one way to interpret it. But in any case, you can see there that they're saying we marry our daughter when they're minors. It's really an exception to the rule. In most places, they would probably only start the process after the girl reached the age of majority. Please.
Not just the case about marrying, about that they didn't really marry, that wasn't really the rule to marry minors, but also it seems in the medieval period they really, they had to ask permission, they had to get the girl's consent, and it sounds like from these stories, not only did they have to get the girl's consent, but the young people were often making their own matches, and then, you know, getting the matchmakers to go to their parents and whatever. But they seem to be making their own matches or meeting each other, whatever. What changed so that later it seemed that that matches were so prearranged. That's so prearranged by the parents.
Okay, so
in later period than the medieval period you're talking about.
Okay, so if we
why did it regress, Caleb?
So I think we have to go back here to some of the Christian background that I was giving at the very, very beginning. Let me make that bigger. And say a word about that. One of the things I said is that the church really made consent into a main point, and we saw that in the Latin sources I brought as well, into a main point of marriage. Now, what Ruth Mazzocaris, a wonderful colleague of mine, says in her book, which is really quite original, her book is called Unmarriages. What she's trying to talk about in her book is connections between men and women that weren't married, but that still were connections that went on for a very long time. That's what she calls it, Unmarriages, and she won all these prizes for this book. In any case, what she says is, all's very well in the 12th century when the church says we need consent. But that consent turns out to be kind of dangerous. Because children can get married without their parents agreeing to it. So what she says is the church was finding that if it wanted to control people's sexual unions, it had to assimilate and declare legitimate the ones they made informally and by their own choice. The church was not entirely happy with the state of affairs, and although it insisted that consent lay with the couple involved, it did not insist on their independence from their parents. This is the beginning of a process in which there is more and more insistence on wider consent. Wider consent meaning the parents have to agree. Wider consent means you need to have a minion of the marriage, which you don't need according to ancient sources. Wider consent means you need to have the rabbi who says everything's okay. Now, if a couple runs away, and in the 16th century they would probably be running to a coffee shop, maybe in the 17th century, and gets married there, and they come back and they present their parents with a fait accompli, one thing is to say we don't have a choice, especially if they've clearly had sex already, maybe a baby's on the way. But the other thing would be for the community to say that marriage is not valid. And in the Christian community, we have more and more people saying those marriages are not valid if they can. So that's really a change of the 14th, 15th, 16th century. As historians who've written about that period, Stephen Osmond, the one I'm thinking about from Harvard, his book is called When Fathers Rule. And that's an attempt to discover this later period, after this insistence on consent, as a period in which parental authority is really called on, patriarchal authority is called on, and then, of course, he describes how that kind of disintegrates as time goes on. Please.
I have one last question about number 5 and number 8, the Tosfot and then the... There are two examples in which a person who's a Tana, later on, he me'enet, she then changes her mind. Now, in the second example, in number 8, it's an example where it says mishudefet. So she was not married, it wasn't a kiddushin, even though I used the word me'un, but she could get out of it because of everything. In the Tosfot, they raise that as a danger. If we allow them to marry as ktanot, then later on they can have moda araba. They can say, wait a minute, I didn't agree, I wasn't old enough to agree. Now, I know that there's a halachic discussion about that, that when the father marries off the ktana, then the daughter doesn't have the right to change her mind
and when she's old enough. If it's a brother, if it's a brother or a mother of an orphan child, then yes. So I'm trying to get, is the assumption of the Tosfot that if this girl got married younger, that she would have the power to say, I never meant it?
Okay, so I'm not sure what the Tosfot means here. I can say something more about source number 8, or something more clearer about source number 8, which is that according to different traditions, and we don't have all that much evidence, there was a ban in the Ashkenazi communities, especially in France, that if you canceled your engagement, you had to pay a certain fine. And this was called a cherem. Now, what's really interesting in this source, if you look at source number 8, and especially if you look at the part that appears on the second page, I'm just looking for it, so I'll have the exact words in front of me, is that in this case, the man sues the father and mother because he wants to get his money back, and the father of the bride says, one second, we don't hold by that. In other words, in our communities, women can back out of these arrangements, and that we have no way to enforce this woman to marry this man. So, I mean, this is something I really have to look into more, and something that I'm working on now, the question of these bans. How strong were they? Where did they exist? What kind of right did these women have to back out? But it seems from many sources that if a woman said, I don't want to marry this man, sometimes her parents would be sued, but she still would be out of that match, and she was free to go marry someone else. So in many ways, that shows the agency these women had in many more ways. Now, maybe that's what the Tosfot are talking about, this ban that they're afraid of, and that's why they don't want her to come back and say after a few years, when the money's already gone and who knows where we'll find it from, we have to take this deal apart and put it back together. I'll just mention that during the same time, a new takana that has to do with marriage is enacted by Rabbeinu Tam, and that's the idea that if a couple gets married and the wife's family has paid a lot of money to have their daughter marry a certain man, and then she dies 6 months later. This business deal didn't work very well. If they'd had a baby together, it would be okay. But they didn't have a baby together. So according to Takanat Rabbeinu Tam, the man has to give the woman's family back all the money that they gave him at the beginning when they got married. 100 years later, this is already a double deal. It's a two-way deal. If both the husband's family and the wife's family gave money for this marriage, both sides have to return the money if one of the two people happened to die during this period after the wedding. So in any case, we can see that this is really a very, very tense matter, how to work out these monies that are involved. Okay, so I think I'll stop with that answer there.
Do we know anything what the divorce rate was at the time and what the reason for the divorce?
Okay, so I just said I'd stop with that answer. You're taking me to where I wanted to go to, which is that one of the things scholars have argued is that there was a very high rate of divorce. And the way they tried to argue that is in two ways. One is by saying if girls got married before they were 12 and they couldn't get out of the marriage before they were 12, they got out of the marriage afterwards by divorcing the guy. So one of the ways of trying to explain the high divorce rate is that. The other way is to try to figure out the divorce rate. That explanation assumes a high divorce rate. How do we get to the idea that there's a high divorce rate in the first place? There are really two ways we reach that conclusion. One is the tshuva of Rabbi Meir ben Baruch of Rotenberg, in which he talks about another woman who is moredit, who's rebelling against her husband. And he says, these women in our times, they're so chutzpahdik. All they do is try to rebel against their husbands all the time. Now, this is one tshuva. Is this rhetoric? Is this really a statement about what's going on? Could it be that that year a number of women got divorced in the community, but for the 5 years before that, no one got divorced? We can't tell by just reading that statement. So that statement, kind of like the Atasha Galutnik Gaveret Aleinu, so everybody marries all three daughters underage, that statement has led scholars to think that many, many people got divorced. The other piece of evidence is a 15th century piece of evidence from a rabbi who wrote down the couples who got divorced in his area. And one scholar, Professor Yisrael Yuval, worked on them, and in some very fancy math, tried to argue that one out of every three couples was divorced. That's an amazingly, amazingly high rate. The only problem is that he only has 11 or 12 couples in the sample. So it's very, very hard to base your sample on such a small number of couples. His wife is a statistician. He does an amazing job with statistics. I have not understood that until this day. I've read the article 3 or 4 times. I'm not saying this against him. I'm saying this against myself. I never took statistics in college, I guess. That's something you learn with an Israeli, that you lose with an Israeli education in the space I would have had to take statistics. But you can't base on one 15th century manuscript that tells 12 divorced couples a divorce rate for all of medieval Europe. So I think there really still a lot of work to be done there to try to figure out how many people are getting divorced. Okay. Thank you very much.